Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the most important, fastest growing, and largest segment of society, to those who have come to realize that the world's political, including their own, religious, military, economic, and media institutions are corrupt, that they become counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, is 877-376-45. Before the program began today, I was doing my morning workout, saw a video of Ray Rice, who is a football player, plays for the Baltimore Ravens. He is a running back. He was under-disciplined by the NFL for its personal conduct policy, two games, for knocking his fiance, now wife, out in an elevator. The TMZ obtained video of what actually occurred in the elevator and of cameras in the building that showed Ray Rice and his fiance obviously having an argument. She's jawing pretty good at him. She turns at one point as they turn around the corner, and she flings an arm back at him. Looks like it hits him in the chest. I mean, it's not an injury kind of thing by even the remotest of circumstances. But she flings an arm at him. She's jawing pretty good at him. They continue to jaw as they walk into the elevator. He gets right up in her grill. And then he punches her twice right in the chin, a haymaker. Second one knocks her out. She falls down to the ground. And then we have the video of him pulling her out unconscious from the elevator. So I was chatting with Scott. I said, well, you know, what do you think? Does this change your perspective on what happened, on the discipline, on the nature of violence among athletes? What do you think, Scott?
No, it doesn't. I don't. Again, like I told you, if you're looking to athletes to be your pillar of morality and that these are good guys, I think you're going to be far more disappointed than not. And it doesn't change the Ray Rice thing before.
Yeah.
I mean, even before I saw the video, I knew it was a bad thing. It's not like when they described it that they didn't describe it exactly like it happened. It was Ray Rice hit his girlfriend. They have video of him dragging her out of the elevator.
Yeah, whatever preceded that couldn't have been good. Who knew it was quite as bad as it turned out to be, but yeah, it couldn't be good.
Yeah, but and then for the NFL to, oh yeah, we made a mistake with Ray Rice, and they saw this video.
And they did.
And they did. But now, rather than them being, again, reasonable, they've gone and implemented this new thing to where, oh, it's six games and then a lifetime ban, which you can reapply for after a year,
or
for reinstatement. So without ever, I mean, obviously this is the case, you know, the Ray Rice thing. If you saw that video, are you not suspending him for more than two games?
Well, they didn't see the video. They saw the video of him dragging him or her out of the elevator. They didn't see the video of actually him hitting her, which is the new video. I have two responses. One is that you are correct. We have this tendency in our world today to turn men and women into superstars. And whether they be athletes or they be actresses or actors or they be performers of one type or another, singers, for example, we turn them into superstars. And what we find is those that have extraordinary talent are amongst the most corrupt. They're the most prone to drug abuse. They're the most prone to violence. They're the most prone to a selfish, self-indulgent, immoral lifestyle. That doesn't mean they all are. There's some that appear to be pretty decent all-around people. You look at Peyton Manning of the quarterback of the Denver Broncos. Appears to be a pretty decent all-around guy. But
at the same time,
there's a lot of people in as the superstars in our sports, the superstars in acting, performing arts, the superstars and singers and the like that are really pretty repulsive.
Yeah, and I think the other thing there is that Peyton Manning doesn't come out and try and tell people what to do or how to think, I mean, you want to talk about football, he'll talk about football with you.
Right.
But you never hear
Peyton
Manning.
You want to talk about his family, he'll talk about his dad, he'll talk about his brother, but he's not going to talk about his wife and children.
Yeah, and he doesn't make comments on, what do you think about the Ray Rice thing? If you ask him about that, he goes, "That's none of my business. I have nothing to do with it."
Yeah, it's true. But I do think there is a tendency for the self-indulgent who have become fabulously rich and fabulously famous, who have people doubting all over them, people virtually worshiping them, seeking their autograph, seeking to touch them, a handshake from them. Those who are elevated in society are in many respects the lowest in society. It's consistent with Yosha's testimony constantly. Yosha's telling us those who would seek to be the greatest will be the least. And those who seek to serve, they will be served. It's why you ought not get caught up in this myth that you have tremendous value, or that you're a great asset, or that you're some kind of a outstanding person. It gets you in nothing but trouble.
To touch on that a little bit more, we have people that are famous. Very famous, like your Paris Hiltons, your whoever the
famous the, only for being famous.
No, they're famous not because of what they do. It's because of what they do, but it's going out and party. They're famous because their parents have money.
Right.
That's it. They've done nothing with their lives, and their parents have money.
Correct.
So that, I can go party all the time. And that's something that people have decided to elevate. And you have girls out there that love Paris Hilton. I mean, I don't know Paris Hilton, but if
there were 100 people that were walk up to me and say, you want to have lunch, for an interesting conversation, she would probably be the last of the group that I would want to have lunch with. It just has absolutely no interest to me. But I understand people are fascinated with celebrity. And it just strikes me that we ought not get caught up in some superlative view of our worth. When you take the attitude of, I'm nobody special. I'm doing what I think is right, trying to share the truth, trying to engage in a meaningful way, trying to help other people understand what's important. But I've got no qualifications that are going to impress anyone. That attitude is vastly more effective than the attitude of, yeah, I'm smart, I'm great, I'm wonderful, you ought to listen to me, you ought to follow me. That gets you in a lot of trouble.
Except for if you are actually smart and you are actually, you have these things, somebody doesn't have to tell you you don't have to tell people how great you are if you're great. You know, if you have all these things that you're bringing to the table, nobody has to tell you that you have those. You don't have to tell people that you have them because they'll be like, yeah, he's a smart guy.
I'd go one step further. I'd say that if you have superlative talent, whatever it might be, you're almost better off being depreciating, self-depreciating, to negate what others might judge as an asset. I think if you go into life humble, if you approach people from a humble position of, I'm not here trying to impress you, I think you'll be a lot better off. It's the entitlement mentality. And unfortunately, Ray Rice, because he's a famous and effective running back in an NFL team, he's going to get by with belting his fiance, and maybe even his sense of entitlement all of his life. He was special when he was in high school, special when he was in college. He was special now that he's in the NFL. Gets paid an enormous amount of money because he's a physical specimen that can succeed in a very popular game. Well, he's all his life. He's felt like he's entitled, like he's special. Never taken responsibility. Never done a self-assessment of what's appropriate in life. And that was pretty sad to see. The NFL is a different story, by the way. The NFL is not a court, so there's no ruling on double jeopardy. You know, and a court of law, yeah, you can't be tried twice for the same crime. Now, with the U.S. government, because it has no affinity for its own constitution anymore, has changed that, and they just simply bring a nuanced claim against you if they want to go after you again and again and again for the same crime, and they do it regularly now. So the idea of double jeopardy doesn't fly in America anymore, even in the legal system, because we don't have a justice system in this country. But that behavior stains the image of the NFL. It's a bad blow for the NFL.
Here again, though, they did it to themselves. They did it to themselves. They could have waited and gotten all the information. How is it that a TMZ has access to the information, but a company like the NFL can't get all this stuff?
Yeah, because the video that we watched this morning came from, obviously it's from the hotel or building management. I don't know if it's a hotel or just an apartment or what kind of a building it is. But
it was
the building
casino. They were out at a casino, I think.
Okay, so it was, all right. So the casinos have cameras everywhere. So it was the casino's video that was that captured it. You know, the casino would have given that video to the police. What's interesting is that I understand how police are reluctant to try a case when you're dependent upon the testimony of someone who doesn't want to testify against, at that time, fiancé, now husband. And so they chose not to charge him because of the fact that his wife wouldn't bring charges. But you don't need someone to bring charges when you have irrefutable evidence.
That seems like a pretty clear cut. The way it was, if I was, I'm not a lawyer, but I feel like I could probably get a conviction on that video.
I would think so, even without the testimony of the fiance, even with the fiance saying, "I forgive him. I'd like you to forgive him." No, it's clearly battery, and he's clearly guilty of battery, and he ought not be in a position where he gets nothing but some community service and a little counseling time. We'll be back in a moment. Before we move on to other news, more important news, we've got Glenn on the line, and Glenn may want to comment on Ray Rice. You're from that part of the country. What do you think on Ray's right?
Oh, well, actually, no. I was calling about your references to being humble. I don't think you mean self-depreciating. I think you meant self-deprecating. Ultimately it could also be self-deprecating. But, you know.
Yeah, self-deprecating. I'm mostly a businessman, and we depreciate assets. So in business, and so I have the tendency to look at, okay, so every individual has strengths and weaknesses, liabilities and assets, and to be cognizant of your liabilities and to depreciate your assets as you approach any endeavor is a wise play. So, but self-depreciating from the asset point of view, as opposed to deprecating, being the appropriate term from a business guy. Maybe I'm gonna pass because that's my mentality.
Or self-deprecating if you really want to be hard on yourself.
Yeah, that would be a little rough.
No, I've heard people with that one anyway.
No, yeah, I know. Yes.
I'm not a grammarian or anything, but I sit around all day. I don't sit around all day, I assure you.
Yes.
But I listen to talk radio, I listen to radio, mm-hmm. and I'm no grammarian or anything, but I'm shaking my head. I'm like, I did have an arts and letters, you know, baccalaureate level education, but mm-hmm. I'm not a grammarian. I'm not a linguist. I'm not anything like this. But I'm stunned when I listen to, like, I went to a very good public school system, a private school, a Catholic school, anything. I had just a good suburban school, and then I went to an enormous state university for, and then transferred to a small college. And, like, being able to write well, like, my first English comp course at enormous state university here in Pennsylvania, my master's degree instructor, like, informed us, like you're going to drop a grade if you have a comma fault, and this is in these papers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, whatever happened to people being able to speak the English language? I'm not even that good, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of things. One is, if you look in minority communities, particularly African-American communities, and you listen to conversations. I brought one up on the air the other day, which was a bystander with a smartphone was recording the aftermath of the encounter between the Michael Brown and Wilson there. And at least every fourth word out of his mouth was a word that I would be fined, yes, for saying. I mean, there's just no reason to use it in ordinary conversation, and yet he's using it repeatedly. And the words that linked the F-bomb were, I don't think he delineated one complete sentence that was grammatically correct. And you actually had to have on this audio, somebody recognized that you had to have on this audio what's the subtitles underneath, so that you have the words written underneath so that you could actually understand what was being said. And this is not all that uncommon in inner cities. And so I think that that's part of it, and that that kind of vernacular, a kind of dialect, is actually celebrated in that community. And that's a tremendous liability. If somebody, you know, I've owned a lot of businesses. If somebody came to me and to interview, and they were talking like that, there's a 0% chance that I would hire them, because they're incapable of communicating appropriately. Now, I think there's other issues, and that is that while we've experimented with outcome-based math, we've also eliminated phonics, and then we've eliminated grammar, I think, just well, as we've eliminated.
When I was young, they brought in this whole phonics thing as opposed to phonetics.
Yes.
I mean, with phonetics, you learn, you know, you like when you open a dictionary and you have the definite, you know, the breakdown of syllables and parentheses off to the right, and you have, like, the breath marks and everything. You learned all that stuff when I was a kid. Yeah. Then they went to phonics, and none of it matters.
Yeah, then it's correct. We began to look at multiple options, all of which are right. Now, and I hear you correctly criticize that I used depreciating instead of deprecating. And I justified, well, I agree with you, I justified depreciating because of the business mentality. We'll be back.
Right.
Welcome back to Chatting This. We're talking about what happened to America in terms of even people who are supposed to be professionals at speaking cannot communicate in a grammatically correct way. We're talking about what are the things that have caused the decline in our written and verbal communication skills. And we've talked about two of them. One of them is that within ethnic communities, there's a tendency to celebrate a unique vernacular. You know, in the Jewish communities, you used to be a corruption of Hebrew that was spoken, where almost every word was not a rude slang, but kind of a unique form of slang. Yeah, it's called Yiddish. And then
thinking about it leaves me for Klimt.
Yeah, and then in the African American community, they're at their unique corruption of the English language actually became a language to be studied in schools, and was to determine whether or not it should be encouraged or discouraged.
Where's Ebonics? Remember Ebonics?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah, Ebonics. So Yiddish and Ebonics. I think that kind of approach is counterproductive. Now, it is the second thing that I mentioned is that outcome-based education, which is a product of political correctness, which is the national religion of academia as well as politics today in the media, that political correctness creates a realm free of judgment and therefore of right and wrong. And in that environment, various corruptions of things can both be viewed as acceptable. And so we've removed right and wrong from grammar. So if there is a verb and subject conflict, it doesn't matter anymore because it's okay.
But Alex Jones even cites all the time the fact that they even go so far as to delve into mathematics and say under like, in this realm, that it's okay if a child says that 2 + 2 = 5, you're not supposed to correct them. And it's
right.
Like, what? You know, I mean, that has actual real-world implications.
Oh,
for,
of course.
You know, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, a rocket designed by an outcome-based mathematician is going to explode.
Yeah.
It's going to kill people.
Exactly.
Go fly in an airplane by somebody who did not get the answers right in math, and see how long you live.
That's what happened to the Malaysian airplane over, the fuel was filled by someone with an outcome-based education.
There you go. Back in early Genesis in the Torah, Yahweh recognized that one of the challenges of humankind, when he created humankind with a nesama, an ability to exercise good judgment, to discern right from wrong, an ability to be moral, that such animals, these humans, Homo sapiens, with a nesama, and the ability to communicate effectively, when the world all spoke Hebrew, one language, that they became enormously powerful and effective. If everybody can communicate effectively with one another, humankind is enormously powerful. Now, typically, we humans, being immoral, use that power poorly. And so, as you know, the world became very corrupt, very dark, very deadly and destructive, and Yahweh rebooted. Said we're going to start all over again. But the story of Babel is all about man becoming too effective, too powerful when we communicate well among one another, when we all speak the same language. And that was the reason that he confused the tongues of men, so that we would begin speaking different languages and not be nearly as corrupt and effective in terms of our corruption. So perhaps the inability today of most people to communicate well is a good thing, considering how evil we've become. I'm going to share with you a third reason I think we've lost the ability to communicate effectively, both in writing and in person. And that is because of the various forms of social media, particularly texting and instant messaging. You're probably aware, Glenn, that the majority of dating relationships now begin online. That's how people, young people meet. I have a son that's married. He obviously doesn't date. I have a son that is still in graduate school. He does date. And while he meets most of the girls that he dates the old-fashioned way in various places, you know, when he's conducting business, just doing things and walks up and talks to somebody, he does still, I think, use one of the free dating sites just because he's not exactly in the most glamorous place in the world for meeting people just to hang with and enjoy the company. And so he was, I gave him some advice the other day, and I said, you know, my understanding is that you use these dating sites, that the standard protocol is that you instant message back and forth on the dating site asking each other kind of questions over like a 2-week period, and then you ask the girl for her phone number, and then you text back and forth for a couple of weeks. You know, you're never going to know what that person's like by instant messaging and texting. You're never going to know if there's any chemistry, any reason to break bread together and have a good conversation. Why don't you just shortcut the whole thing? And somebody approaches you on one of those sites, instant message for a few times back and forth, ask for the number, text a few times back and forth, and then say, would you like to go out to lunch? And on, and if cutting through all of it, getting to a personal meeting where you can actually talk to one another is threatening to them, then there are 1,000 more out there.
Well, of course, you have to meet at an airport food court so that the TSA can pat you down and everybody can, you know, serve, make sure you're not a killer.
You know, there are a lot of things that are different in our work. You know, when I asked a girl out, of course, we did not have, back in the Stone Age, we didn't have text messaging. We didn't even have smartphones. We didn't have email or any of that kind of thing. We didn't even have websites back in the Stone Age. And back at that time, it was considered chivalrous, appropriate, that the gentleman would pick the young lady up at wherever she lived and would take her to dinner and then something entertaining and then drive her home, and that he would open the car door for her. He would pay the bill, and you know, that was considered appropriate. That's what a man did in a dating situation. Now, if my son asked to pick up a girl on a date, she's threatened. No, they drive independently on first, second, and third dates, and they meet at a public place. The guy does not come and pick her up, and if you try to open a car door, they look at you like, are you from Mars?
Right, exactly. Like you're a bumpkin or something.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Phyllis Schlafly does a great commentary on that sort of stuff. It's, you know, about how women have really allowed themselves to be shortchanged throughout this whole process.
They have.
The language thing, first of all, the social, the computer dating thing has given us the concept of the geographically undesirable relationship. You didn't meet somebody online, but they're a prohibitive distance away from you.
Correct.
So there's something to be said for, like, that's how you think about dating in college. You meet someone, you walk over to a different dorm area and meet someone in a lobby and go out.
Correct. Yeah, it's a whole different scenario. I agree with you. But I do think that the texting and social media and the non-personal connection, moving from analog to digital, has been a tremendous disservice in our ability to communicate with one another.
Oh, yeah. And I'll tie this in actually to something useful in just a second. One thing I want to put about computers. Computers all had their own languages, their own compilers. And you had to get everything correct. And people learned those languages, and they learned them well. Because if they didn't, the computer would say error and spit it out and stop working. So humans still have the capacity to learn languages. They acquiesced to the necessity when they were learning computer languages. Then they came out with the reduced instruction set computers. You know, there's way too much verbiage here. Let's just, if we can cut down the instruction set, you know, we can have a lot fewer characters and get a lot more done. And we're doing essentially the same thing with languages. Now, last week you pointed out the illiteracy.
The languages now are compiling.
And then the
nouns are now compiling, and they're applications based, so that rather than writing the code to achieve a result, now in computer programming, you're applying an application that already has the code written underneath it. So you just choose the application almost like a drag and drop, as opposed to actually writing the code to achieve the results, so that the logic and the flow of the entire process is now removed from the process of writing software programs.
Right. And you have all this pre-written, you know, backstack things already in place. But now, to tie this back to something useful regarding Yahweh, you pointed out last week the notion about the structure of the tabernacle and people being illiterate and stuff like that. I would I would, you know, it's interesting in the power of, you know, appearance and symbology and things like the tabernacle or temples or even churches or whatever, the whole architectural element. But symbol, whether you're dealing with words and languages, you still have to deal with explaining the symbols. And, you know, or even how Hebrew is a pictographic language. So this all ties together, you know.
I agree. Yeah, because in Hebrew, first of all, there are many parables and many symbols that convey aspects of Yahweh's nature or the purpose of the covenant. But beyond that, the language itself was written in symbols. The alphabetic characters that comprise the words were all drawings, and they were drawings of things that people could look at and understand. So many, maybe not all, but certainly a significant percentage of Hebrew words were drawn in the sense that someone could look at them and say, oh, I get it. That's what this means, because I understand that tent means home and family. That I understand a hand reaching down and out means that that's the symbol of a father reaching down and lifting up his children. I understand that the tent peg makes a home more secure. I understand that the shepherd's staff is that leads and nurtures and protects his or her flock. And so I know that the eye provides access to both observation, but also provides a sense of perspective. I understand the teeth represent where words come out and where we receive nourishment. We can literally be nourished on words. I spoke right through your last comment. We'll address it in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. Glenn, I spoke right over your last point. Got kind of carried away at the last segment, I apologize.
No, I was just supporting what you were saying. In the Hebrew alphabet, I'll never forget when I learned that sin and shin were alternately facing bows and arrows. And that's why, you know, to sin is to miss the target. It's to fall short of the mark. You know, and that's always made a huge impression on me. So just by learning the pictography of the characters of the Hebrew alphabet, you start to get an idea of the things that are important to Yahweh and his character and his communications with us. This is right in the alphabet he gives, you know, for us to use as communication.
Yeah. And like, for example, the Hebrew word father. It's a combination of a male lamb, so it's a ram, you know, a lamb with horns. So it's the male lamb is the first letter, that's the Aleph, and the Beth is a picture of a home. So the father, the male in the home, is the graphic for the Hebrew word father. And if you go from the Hebrew word father, for example, then to the Hebrew word for mighty one or God, you start off with the male lamb, which is a defender of the flock, of the leader of the flock, the ram. And you combine that with the lamed, which is a shepherd's staff to lead, to protect, and to nourish the flock. And you have now the symbolic graphics that define the word God. The most important Hebrew word is probably Bereth. And, you know, the first letter of Bereth is the picture of a home. The Beth in Hebrew is the floor plan of a home. The Rosh, it means first. It means top. It's a picture of a head. So it's the foremost home. And the Y in Hebrew is Yahweh's hand reaching down and out to us, followed by the T, which is the sign or symbol or signature or mark of a individual. So you look at the letters, and you say, oh, well, okay, I understand what that means.
Yeah, God's telling you something about himself just in the alphabet itself. We see, you know, the protective alpha ram, you know, is depicted there. And looking around at the leadership of our world today, and we see mostly Judas goats.
Yeah, that's true.
not the protective alpha ram.
Right.
You know.
Right. It's a marvelous picture of, and even you look at the most interesting, I think, of all pictures is is the way that we as humans are an upright being that can stand up and use our hands to engage, our feet to be upright as opposed to bow down or on our knees or looking down at the ground. We can look up, we can look out, we can engage with our hands. We as a animal come together as men and women, forming long-term bonds, building a home, building a family, contributing to and conceiving children, raising them in a loving, nurturing environment where they are initially dependent, and we do everything we can to help them grow, to learn, to become more than we are. And you compare the human experience to the covenant, and you say, boy, you know, I think that was by design, because the covenant's identical.
Right. Now, I myself have no problem with people, you know, kneeling and praying or, that's the notion of humble yourself in the sight of Yahweh, and he'll lift you up. You know, or Yahusha spoke of the man who knelt and rent his garments and beat his breast, you know, and went away justified, you know, yeah. Or we see Daniel kneeling in prayer several times a day.
Yeah, but almost all of Daniel's kneeling was depicted in one place where he was in a complete revolt against the Babylonian edict that required the subjects of Babylon to kneel down and acknowledge that the king was God. And so what we do is have Daniel look out over Jerusalem and get to the highest place in his home and say, look at me, I'm going to bow down here, but I'm going to bow down in the opposite direction just to show that I'm in absolute defiance of your edict. So while I think that the humble heart, the recognition that we are flawed individuals and that we benefit from Yahweh lifting us up is the proper attitude, you'll never find me on my knees. I'm always standing up and engaged with Yahweh, which I think is the way he wants it. We'll be back.